You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Isabel Allende's latest novel, Island Beneath the Sea, begins in Haiti at the end of the 18th century. A young slave becomes the concubine of her owner, a French planter whose Spanish wife has gone mad. From there onward, the plot gets complicated, involving a quadroon courtesan and her lovers, children born out of wedlock, an escape to New Orleans, and the revolution in Haiti. It's published by Harper, and I'm delighted that it brings the internationally best-selling author Isabel Allende back to our show today. So it's a pleasure to see you, Isabel.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to see you.
Now, you're best known for your books about Latin America and California, and now suddenly Haiti during the era of slavery?
I wasn't planning it. It just fell on my lap. I was planning a novel about New Orleans because I just love that city. And then when I started studying the history, I realized that 10,000 refugees had fled from the slave revolt in what is today Haiti and had gone to New Orleans. So they were French white people escaping from the colony, and they brought with them their domestic slaves and their concubines of color and their children of mixed race. And in New Orleans, there was a class of free people of color that had economic resources, education. It was a golden era for them. So that was a very interesting subject. I just had to research about Haiti and go back to those refugees before they came.
New Orleans being our most French city.
Yes.
In this country. But it's interesting that although Haiti was a French colony, your plantation owner is Spanish.
No, my plantation owner is French. He has a Spanish brother-in-law that they're very good friends.
And his wife is Spanish. I'm sorry.
Yeah, the wife is Spanish. Well, that was because he meets her in Cuba. And many people from Europe, women from Europe, married people who lived in the colonies, and they went mad. They couldn't stand the weather, the mosquitoes, and the climate of terror in which people lived. Because not only the slaves lived in terror, also the whites, because they could be assassinated any moment. There could be a revolt, and there was a revolt eventually.
Well, there were a couple of revolts, but then a successful one. Yeah. Who lived in Haiti before the Europeans arrived and before the
Indians.
Africans were brought in as slaves?
The Arawako Indians.
And they were all gone?
Eliminated by the Spaniards completely. There was not one left by the time it became a French colony.
And why was that? Do you know?
Because they couldn't put them in slavery. The Spaniards try to enslave all the indigenous people in every country they conquered, and some of them were simply not willing. They preferred to die. And also there were the European diseases that they brought with them.
Your protagonist, Tete, is a slave who sleeps with Valmoran, the white owner of the sugar plantation.
Let's say that she's raped by Valmoran.
But then they have a relationship.
Yeah, eventually they do.
What does Valmoran feel for Tete?
I think that it's a mixed feeling. What was fascinating while I was researching about slavery is that it's such a complicated and complex thing. It's not simple at all. It's not master and slave. They were family. I'm talking about domestic slaves. They became family. There were relationships. There was love, hatred, power, submission, incest. A lot of very interesting subjects to write about.
Edward P. Jones wrote a wonderful book about a black slave owner in America.
Yeah, yeah.
And when his father tries to buy his freedom before he becomes a slave owner in his own right, his owner keeps on raising the price because he loves him
so much.
It's his son.
Yeah, and in this case, Tete has come to this man when she was 9 years old, has been with him all her life practically, and he really has a relationship with her. That is interdependency, and he doesn't want to free her, although he owes her her freedom, because he doesn't want to lose her.
Okay, he says he dislikes slavery, but he imagines that she loves him.
Yes, when he realizes how disgusted she is with this relationship and how much she really wants to get out, he's shocked. He's shocked. He can't believe that she doesn't feel for him what he feels for her.
Would his wife even be aware of this relationship?
She was mad. But
if
she was not mad,
crazy people can still know that something is going on.
Yeah, but I think that if she was aware, she couldn't stop it because this happened all the time.
As I said, Val Morin says he dislikes slavery, but that somebody has to manage the colonies of people or to have sugar and cigars. So how common do you think that attitude was among the slaveries? Did they see slavery simply as a necessary sin for satisfying the demands of the world?
For centuries, that was the case, until the abolitionist movements were more powerful than the other side.
Now, there was a strong abolitionist movement in England in the early 19th century. What about in France?
There was some, too, in France. In France, slavery had been abolished at that time, but not in the colonies, because Saint-Domingue, which is now Haiti, was the richest French colony, and it was all worked by slaves. They couldn't. It would have broken the back of the colony.
The owners' relations with the slaves were dictated by the Code Noir. Mm-hmm. What was that?
The Black Code. It was Código Negro. It also applied in Spain. It was a set of rules that determined how much you could punish a slave or the responsibilities you had with a slave. For example, you couldn't sell a child before if he was younger than 7 years old. Because supposedly the mother would have to be with the child at that age. Or you couldn't punish the slave more than so many lashes or whatever. It was brutal, seen from our perspective today. But at the time, at least, it sort of regulated a little bit the whole thing. Nobody applied it much. One of the things in the plantations, the Code Noir demanded that the slaves be given 2 hours of free time at lunchtime because it was the hottest time of the day. That never was applied.
There also were categories. There were the Grand Blanc, the Petit Blanc, the Affranchi.
The Grand Blanc were the whites that had money and had the land, and those were monarchists. Then the Petit Blanc were the civil servants, priests, soldiers, whites with no money. Mm-hmm. And then there were the Affranchi, and the Affranchi were people of color that had been emancipated, usually by the father, and given some money, and they were prosperous, many of them, and they wanted to identify with the whites. But the Petit Blanc, the poor whites, hated them. They hated each other terribly.
The Affranchi probably are the precursors of the elite
in Haiti.
In Haiti.
Absolutely.
Nowadays. Tete's godmother, Tata Rose, is a mambo or a practitioner of voodoo. What kinds of powers does she have?
She knew the land. She knew the herbs. She was a medicine woman. And so that she had that power. And then when the revolution started, voodoo was extremely important because the spiritual beliefs kept them going and gave them incredible, superhuman courage. They really believed that the souls of the dead would rise from the island beneath the sea, which was Guinea, paradise, and come and fight with them against the French soldiers. And they won the battles. So eventually the French soldiers thought that really the spirits were fighting with them. And so the mambos or the practitioners like Tante Rose became very important because they were the liaisons between the plantations.
But it also represent a competition with Catholicism. What was the situation for the plantation owners? Were they interested in saving souls?
No, not at all.
Didn't they force conversions to Catholicism?
Yeah, part of the Code Noir was that they had to baptize the slaves. So when they disembarked in the port, they were baptized in mass, and then sent to the plantations, and that was it. There was never any enforcement of the religion. And so there was a syncretism of religions because the people who came from Africa came from different places. Some of them were Muslim, actually. And there was a syncretism that created this thing called voodoo that was an incredible, powerful religion.
It's interesting that in so many of the slave countries there was this syncretism. In Cuba, you get Santeria.
And in Brazil, the Candomblé.
And it pretty much all the same sort of thing, adapting the Catholic saints and various aspects of Catholicism to the African religion.
Well, when Catholicism was very repressive and they would punish them if they practiced any other religion, then they would disguise the loas with the attributes of the saints. And in Brazil, this is really clear because you see they have the Orisha name and then they have the Catholic name.
Yeah, in Cuba too. Chango becomes Santa Barbara.
Exactly.
another character in the book, Violette, is a quadroon. A quadroon being a very light-skinned...
A grandmother or a grandfather is black and the rest are white.
She becomes a courtesan and a businesswoman, and she'd been freed because her freedom had been bought or because she was so light?
She was born free because her mother had been a mulatta that was freed by her lover. And so she was born free and she became, like, there was a class also in Saint-Domingue of people of color, especially these courtesans that were very famous. They were beautiful and trained for pleasure and very refined.
The plantation's overseer, Cambrai, believes it's more profitable to replace slaves than to treat them with consideration. So how long did the average slave live?
4 to 6 years if they were field hands in a sugar plantation.
4 to 6 years?
In a sugar plantation.
And what did they usually die of?
Well, they were worked 16 to 18 or 20 hours a day. They were fed a powder that made of fish, in rotten fish that came from the United States, worse than dogs. And they were all kinds of diseases, mosquitoes, the weather, and punishment.
So was this worse than slavery in Cuba or in southern United States?
It was awful.
And so I guess we shouldn't be surprised that this is where the first successful slave revolt took place.
Yeah, but also take in consideration the numbers. There were 500,000 slaves and 20,000 whites and 14,000 affranchis. So how do you control? I mean, they had the army and the militia, but how do you control it?
One of your characters, a young slave named Gambo, runs away to join the Maroons. Who were the Maroons?
The Maroons were those the fugitives. The alternative for a slave was to run away or to die. And death was a liberation. But many, many escaped. From the very beginning of the colony, they would escape. And there were whole villages up in the mountains of Maroons that would raid the plantations at night to get tools and animals and vegetables or whatever. And many died of hunger up there. And the militia couldn't get them because the militia was always on horseback or on muleback. And the mountains were very steep.
Now, I'm assuming you went to Haiti to
do the research for the book. I'd been there before. But not for the book because it was another country 200 years ago. It was covered with fertile soil and forest. And today it's a very different place.
And then, of course, came the earthquake.
Yeah, well, the earthquake came. I mean, it's an eerie coincidence that it would come when I'm publishing the book. But I really started the book 4 years ago.
You used to be a journalist in Chile. How has that influenced your writing of fiction and memoirs? Because a listener from Connecticut wants to know what you did before you wrote your first novel.
I was a journalist when I was young. Then we had the military coup in Chile in 1973. I went to Venezuela and...
And your name is a name that is directly associated with that.
Yeah. And so
not Pinochet.
Not with Pinochet, yeah. And so I went to Venezuela where I couldn't find a job as a journalist. And I did all sorts of odd jobs until I wrote my first book. But what I learned in journalism has been so important for fiction writing.
In what way?
Well, first of all, use of language, to make language efficient, to keep in mind that you have a reader. You have to grab the reader's attention. How to research, how to conduct an interview, all that's important.
But although you live in California, you continue to write in Spanish. Are you writing in Spanish with the fact that most of your readers are going to wind up reading you in translation in mind?
No, I don't keep that in mind. But what I keep in mind is that I do the research in English. I translate it into Spanish, and then my translator has to put it back into English. So that's really complicated.
And I would assume you could write in English.
No, I can't write fiction in English. I could write a speech, but not fiction.
Mm-hmm. Then I also assume that no matter how sophisticated the translator, you are consulted.
Oh, we work closely, but not because she consults me. I think I consult her.
Well, there are certain things that even a translator will find a little confusing. What did you really mean by this? Even if you're editing from English to English.
What is difficult is humor, often irony, the subtlety of irony, which is so cultural. It's not translating the words. It's very cultural. Something that is funny in Chile would be terribly politically incorrect in the United States.
You do have one of the great translators, Margaret Sayers-Petten, doing the translation of this book. Have you worked with her before?
All my books, except the first. So we've had, she has been in my life longer than any husband.
This book is full of action and romance, the sort of thing that people who make movies love. And a number of your previous books have been made into movies. And you talk about it with this book?
Not yet. And it's hard, the movie business. You know, they want the rights for everything, forever, for perpetuity in this planet and the universe to be discovered. It's hard.
In the case of the future, who knows what the people who, what they call the nene of Avatar? They may very well. They might very well want to see that movie. We don't want them to be able to see it for free, do we? Isabel Allende's latest novel is called Island Beneath the Sea. It is published by Harper. And I want to thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.